Welcome to our panel, Salmon and Their Many Damn Problems. Sort of gives away what does a salmon say when it has a headache. Damn. I'm David Helvig. I'm moderating today's panel. I'm a longtime SEJ member, author and writer and co-host of the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Just 3 days ago, a study published 3 days ago in Fish and Fisheries found a 70% decline in wild Chinook salmon stocks between California and British Columbia over the last 50 years, including spring runs on the Klamath River in California and here on the Snake River. But before I go any further, I want to thank Dave Kenny of Trout Unlimited, who really helped land this panel, excellent panel today. And as I said, it was just 2 weeks ago, I talked to a member of the Yurok tribe on the Klamath River who said there are some people who like to eat salmon, some people who need to eat salmon. Salmon's been part of the culture and nutrition of northwestern tribes and for thousands of years. It's also created a thriving commercial fishery since colonial settler times. It's iconic, heroic fish, incredible life cycle, migration, connects freshwater and the ocean, and then brings nutrients back into the forest of Idaho. And it's unlike a lot of fish, it holds a kind of iconic place, like sharks. It's a keystone species in a system that's complex and threatened. We'll discuss the range of threats salmon are facing and solutions being sought. But interestingly, starting in June and ending next year, 4 dams are coming down on the Klamath River, where I live in Northern California. The largest dam removal in U.S. history up till the present. It's going to open up about 200 miles of, I can't call them new spawning grounds, but spawning grounds that haven't been available to fish for over 100 years. At the same time, they closed down our salmon fishery this year in California, and so it's almost a zero point. We had the atmospheric rivers that flooded our state, but also ended a 3-year drought. It's uncertain if there would have been fish to come up to this new open river. Now there's hope that the dams come back down by 24 and that in 2025, 2026, we'll see returns of salmon to habitat they haven't had for over a century. And it's something that's happening in California, but it's something that's very much part of the discussion now here in Idaho and downriver in Washington and Oregon. And, you know, I got a panel, as I said, that Dave helped put together a panel that's probably as knowledgeable about salmon as any group of bears on the riverbank. So there's Shannon Wheeler, who's vice chair of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee. There's Helen Neville, senior scientist with Trout Unlimited. Bill Florey is diversified grain farm manager at Florey Farms. He's also on the Wheat Marketing Center and the Idaho Grain Producers Association. And Eric Barker is the outdoor and environmental editor at the Lewiston Tribune, who has been covering the salmon beat for a while. They'll each speak briefly, and then we'll have a discussion, but we're going to leave plenty of time for questions and answers at the end. Just a reminder, the rules are questions should come from first and foremost from members of SEJ or other journalist associations. But with that, let's just start with our brief introductions and comments from each of our members, starting with the vice chair.
Thank you for the – I don't know if this is on. Is that on? Okay. All right. Good afternoon. Tatsalah. My name is Shannon Wheeler. I serve as the vice chairman for the Nez Perce tribe. My name is Wiyawiyokpu. It was an old village site on the Lower Snake River. That name comes from my grandfather, our great-great-grandfather, who later when he took his English name, he became the Reverend William Wheeler. And so that's basically a name that I carry with me, and it means a lot to me. And in this day and age where, you know, our people have taken something from our creation story that asks us to be the voice of salmon to this point today, to where that meaning actually is greater than ever. So an understanding of the different voices of how we speak for salmon, whether it's through prayer, honoring, and many different other ways that we would be the voice. This is a voice of our brother, our sister that's on life support. With that, I'll stop right there.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Miller. Can you hear me okay? Okay. As David noted, I'm the senior scientist for Trout Unlimited, so I span nationally for the organization, but live here in Boise, Idaho, with the Snake River in our backyard. It's a very special place to us as a family. And I have expertise in evolutionary biology and conservation genetics of western trout and salmon, and have published several papers on Chinook salmon in the Snake River, in the Middle Fork Salmon River in particular. So as you absorb what Vice Chairman Wheeler just conveyed so impactfully, I'm going to take an entirely different approach and just sort of focus on the fish and the fish situation today, partly because I think proponents of the hydro system often throw out inaccurate information to try and confuse the issue and make it seem more uncertain than it is in terms of the status of the fish and where we need to go. So I wanted to orient you around some of that information as you might dig into the issue. So first I'm going to tell you what the science tells us about salmon and steelhead runs on the Snake River. And secondly, I'm going to characterize the scientific consensus that moving the dams is essential to ensure a future for these fish. But let me begin by talking about why we should all care about salmon and steelhead, and especially those in the Snake River. Salmon and steelhead are remarkable creatures. For over millions of years, they have been shaped by an incredibly dynamic landscape, including floods of biblical proportions, fires, droughts, and even an ocean that was once 115 meters below what it is today. And as products of this environment, our modern salmon and steelhead have developed a diversity of life history strategies to continue to provide remarkable resilience in the face of change, and that's something I want you to remember towards the end of what I'm going to say today. So in an amazing feat, each year our Snake River fish travel up to 900 miles and over a mile in elevation to access these headwaters. And despite all odds, they continue to do this because they are anchored here by the coldest and most undisturbed habitat remaining in the West. And this habitat will become increasingly important with climate change. Across the current native distribution of West Coast salmon and steelhead in the lower 48, the Snake River Basin holds 40% of the accessible cold water habitat today, and that number is expected to increase to 45% by 2080. So these fish and their habitats are simply irreplaceable if we care about salmon and steelhead in the West. So first off, I wanted to talk about some of the information you might hear as you dig into this story. You will hear that those who want to suggest that we can keep these four dams and our Snake River salmon too, that they will say things like, dam passage survival for smolts is 96%. That's a fact that you hear quite frequently out here. And that fact is actually correct, but it is a dam performance metric that measures only the survival of a fish from the top of a dam to the bottom of the dam, from one concrete structure. So that statistic in no way reflects the cumulative and full impacts of these dams, which are important to understand. First, it doesn't even consider the cumulative impact of having to go across that structure 8 times. It does not consider the impact of the slow-moving, hot, and food-depauperate reservoirs these fish must navigate behind each dam, where they are exposed to extensive metabolic stress and an onslaught of predation, that their passage takes over 10 times longer today than it did historically, and now requires active swimming instead of passive migration, that they arrive then in the ocean in poorer condition with inappropriate timing for the complex physiology needed to enter salt water. And that statistic does not encompass the significant delayed mortality or mortality that occurs later after passage in the ocean or even on their return, but that is directly attributable to their passage experience. So when you consider all of these factors and the cumulative impact, the research actually suggests the mortality just downstream and back to the mouth of the Columbia on return is around 20 to 25% per dam. And that doesn't even consider the mortality as they continue upstream. So upstream passage mortality from the dams is actually fairly low per dam. But again, cumulatively, it can take a significant toll on these fish, especially under stressful conditions like high temperatures like we experienced in 2015 when almost the, you know, all of our returning sockeye perished. You'll also come across numbers that related to ESA species that can bind different stocks or counts of hatchery fish with wild fish, but we must distinguish these because wild returns of individual stocks comprise the legal mandate for recovery under the Endangered Species Act. And even for wild fish of a listed stock, like Snake River, Spring, Summer, Chinook, you'll hear things like, runs are up almost 150% this year. But I want you to recognize that our salmon are down to less than 5% of their historic abundances. Yes, improved ocean conditions over the last few years have given us a little bump over the previous year, but we know it won't be sustained because we've seen this before and it is unsustainable with these dams in place. And it is basically nothing bouncing around at the bottom of nothing, at the bottom of a very steep and downward trend. So for context, even with the uptick this past year, when returns are averaged, as they must be, we are only at about a quarter of the delisting threshold for just the minimum need to recover. Our populations are not replacing themselves ecologically, and downstream populations that pass only three or four dams are returning at sustainable rates, typically 3 to 4 times and sometimes much higher than Snake River stocks. So the final thing I wanted to leave you with that is it is just abundantly clear based on decades of consistent science that without removal of the four lower snake dams, the current downward trajectory will continue leading these fish to extinction. And this view is held by an overwhelming majority of salmon experts, including tribal, state, federal agency scientists. And it's also important to realize that dam removal is no longer an experimental idea, but it's rather a proven action to enable salmon and steelhead to demonstrate their amazing resilience, as we're seeing in the Elwha River, for instance, now that salmon are coming back and rebounding and re-expressing life histories not sustained in that system for over 100 years. It's remarkable. So this is why the American Fisheries Society, which represents over 7,500 fishery professionals, including myself, earlier this year released a science-based statement calling for the removal of the dams. It's why NOAA's 2020 report emphasized that removal of these dams must be a centerpiece action for recovery to reduce direct and indirect mortality from the hydro system. So in closing, the Snake River salmon and steelhead are remarkable and irreplaceable creatures that have the resilience to respond to dramatic change, but they are truly hitting the limits of their capacity with these structures. The Snake River represents the best last place for salmon and steelhead, and decades of science demonstrates consistently that we must remove the four lower snake dams in a proven strategy for recovery for the future of these fish.
Thank you. And Bill?
Yeah, thank you, David. I'm a fourth-generation producer, 118 years here in the Lewiston area for the farm. Flory Farms has a motto of growing for a hungry world, and we take that seriously. I grew up in the Lewiston area, and I can remember early grade school down in the Snake River between Lewiston and Clarkston. The high school kids walking across the river while we were trying to find a place to cool off with very little flows, and how that's changed. So let's go to 1971 when they began the final completion of the eighth dam provides Lewiston 416 miles to the mouth of the Columbia through eight dams, which are noted up there, and 712 feet of elevation change from Lewiston to the mouth. And incidentally, Lewiston is the lowest point in Idaho. Doesn't seem like it, but it is. And, so scientists back in 1971 said the levees that were built around Lewiston to protect downtown would leak and flood the lower levels of downtown. Well, fortunately, the engineers were correct. They haven't. Grain delivered to terminals there in Lewiston and Clarkston, the two ports, started out at 26 cents off coast. That was the freight and the put through at the terminals. That was the net back to the producer off of coast. That came down from 40 cents when truck and rail were the methods of transport to Portland. Now that number is 76 cents. And you think, okay, that's over 52 years. It's only that put through with two modes of competitive transportation and inflation have gone up 292% in 52 years. That's quite an economic success story. And also in 71, international trade teams arrived in Lewiston and marveled at the ingenuity, efficiency, market, and the ability to for the market to respond to the international world. 3.5 days, if my truck's unloading in one of the ports in Lewiston and Clarkston, 3.5 days that grain can be on an ocean vessel on the Willamette or the Columbia and be heading toward the mouth of the toward the ocean for our export customers. It allowed the industry to become reliable and a great supplier to Asia, Central and Central America markets. And right now, we have better than 95% of the market share, wheat purchase market share in the Philippines. And that's been quite a success story and very consistent. Another thing that happened in 71 with the last dam in the slack water, fresh water clams and other species thrived. Let's go to now. 100 million bushels of wheat go through the top four, the lower four Snake River dams a year, and that's not including barley, wood products, lumber products, and so that 100 million would take 201 unit trains of 105 cars each, or it would take 23 million truck miles to move that same grain. The Columbia River corridor, the capacity of it is over 96% utilized with rail to Portland, and only 60% utilized with barge traffic. During harvest, it takes four barges, about 1.3 unit trains a day to keep the ports in Lewiston and Clarkston open with the production that's coming at them. It's truly impressive. But let's talk about some solutions that we need, I think, before we finally breach the dams. So let's talk about predators. Orcas, sea lions, and walleye, and their habitat that gives them a distinct advantage. Let's talk about the warmer, inconsistent ocean habitat temperatures that may not always be friendly to salmon. Let's talk about the rail bed erosion along the reservoir that goes downriver and provides rail service into Lewiston. When the test drawdown occurred, we had rail bed erosion because of the water not supporting one side of the levee where the rail is. Also, we need to find solutions on how to keep wheat barley competitive in single mode transportation, or find alternatives. In a great example of ton mile per gallon numbers are. Barges move 675 ton miles per gallon. Railroads at 70% of that efficiency move 472 ton miles per gallon, and trucks move 151 ton miles per gallon, which is 22%. So we also need to find some solutions quickly on methane release. Behind each dam, if you figured 40 miles, 300 feet wide, that'd be basically 1,400 acres of river bottom exposure, and the wetlands, the mud, the noxious weeds, and whatever else may occur exposure to that. And we also need to talk about food insecurity. 850 million people in the world are hungry and face food insecurity every day. And we need to make sure that the U.S. remains highly competitive and available and reliable source of food.
Okay. I think that's a good point to move on. We'll discuss all solutions. Eric, you've been covering it. You got some solutions. You've been doing some interesting stories.
Yeah, well, the solution that people have been pushing for and talking about for a long time is, of course, dam removal. I just want to quickly orient everybody. I'm from the Lewiston Tribune. It's at the confluence of the Clearwater and Snake Rivers, which is where those two red lines join, just kind of down and to the right of the 8, right on the border. Lewiston's in Idaho, Clarkston's in Washington, right across the river. Everything you see there in red is Snake River and its tributaries. And the four dams built in the 60s, largely to provide tug and barge transportation, but they do have hydropower. They do have fish passage, so we still have fish. We still have wild fish, and we still have hatchery fish. Spring Chinook season opens tomorrow, and we're hoping it's going to be a good one. The run is late, and so folks are kind of nervous. The fish were listed in the 90s. Almost immediately, there was proposals to breach the dams, not taken seriously at all, and over those 25 years, it's become more and more of a serious proposal. It was really elevated in 2021 when Representative Mike Simpson, he represents the 2nd Congressional District in Idaho, so sort of the southern half of the state, proposed a dam breaching package, $35 billion. It would remove the dams and spend a lot of money to make people whole. At the time, there was thought that this might get swept up and Build Back Better and infrastructure funding, and this might be something that happened really fast. It didn't. He hoped that it would be that other congressional members would jump on board, and they were pretty lukewarm to it. In the meantime, Senator Murray from Washington and Governor Jay Inslee studied the issue. They agreed that the dams probably need to be breached, but they said not now. We need to replace those services first. So for the 25 years I've covered this, it's mostly been advocates, the Nez Perce Tribe, Oregon, fishing, environmental groups trying to convince the federal government to – federal agencies to recommend to Congress to breach the dams. Simpson comes along. He kind of elevates that. When it didn't happen immediately, it looked like maybe it would sink down. But then now it appears that the Biden administration is sort of incrementally moving in that direction. So we're kind of in a new spot in my career and in this movement. And we don't know exactly where we are or where we're going, but we're closer to breaching than ever before, but perhaps still a long ways away. And let's turn it back to you, Dave.
Right, because I was looking at that report from 3 days ago. It said, 70% decline since 50 years ago. And then I realized 50 years ago I was reporting on the troubles in Northern Ireland. It's not that far ago. You go a century earlier, you're talking millions of fish, not thousands. So what is interesting and new in this, I watched over the last 20 years the fight over the Klamath and their smaller dams with less production attached to them. But Mike Simpson's got that $35 billion, a lot of it is going to stakeholders to look at how to transport ag, how to deal with recreational issues. It seems strange, as I'm looking at, though, that even though the headwaters are in Idaho, where the fish will get to spawn, that the politics of that $35 billion is really about Washington, D.C., Washington State, and the tribes, and that the Democrats did ignore Simpson when he first came out to report until the tribes came out in support of it. And the tribes are also a legal entity in all of this. And maybe, Shannon, you could start by just talking about what sovereign tribal nations play in this political process. What role?
Certainly. I definitely appreciate that, too, as well. And I appreciate the map and the comments here, and they're all concerns. And what you're looking at in the shaded area is the Columbia Basin region. Well, we call that salmon country. That's the salmon basin. That's the great salmon basin. That's what Lewis and Clark found in the Core of Discovery. That's what Hudson Bay found, the East India Trading Corporation. That's what they found, and they've seen the riches of that. That's why we have such rich soils out here. That's why agriculture is so great in this region. But at the same time, you know, that great Salmon Basin there has had a lot of issues when once the dams came in. And we could point to a lot of things. I mean, I could point to ocean conditions. Well, that was as of recent. But the decline of salmon started back in the when the inception of the first dam started, and some of them were eradicated because of zero passage, and so that has happened, and we know that has happened, and the Army Corps of Engineers knew what was going to happen when they put these dams in, so we know all that. They knew the science before. So what Congressman Simpson brought forward and what he was going to do, and his plan, of course, he was actually solving for energy. Problem solving for energy, but you had to solve for salmon too at the same time. And so he recognizes his obligation to tribes like the Nez Perce as a sovereign, and our and how what role we play in the United States of America as a sovereign, and the responsibility of a sovereign of the United States to the sovereign that they have a treaty with. There's obligation. There's special interest groups that, you know, have a stake in it. They're stakeholders. You know, they're the stakeholders. But we're a sovereign. We're a sovereign that granted rights to the United States of America to pass through our lands. We give 13.2 million acres. And so if you're looking up there where Oregon's at, where Idaho's at, where it says Lower Granite, well, that's all the original Nez Perce territory there. ICC goes clear to the edge of the state of Idaho. That's the Indian Claims Commission. That goes to where the Idaho border is on the eastern side. And then it goes over to down on the Snake River about where number 7 is right there, and then down to the Oregon. But our usual and custom is between the Cascades and Bitterroots, and extends into the mouth of the Columbia and then into Buffalo Country. But that originally is salmon country. That's originally our ability to be able to administer something that was our right to be able to do, to grant the United States the right to passage to come through, so that the agriculture south of the days of the Civil War and the industrial north could prosper. So this country could prosper to what it is today. And certainly a negotiation with the Nez Perce tribe, which opened that up and opened up the greater Asian Pacific Rim for a trade for America. So we understand the numbers that Mr. Flores was bringing forward, and we understand what gross domestic product is, and we understand that those are important to the negotiation for the United States with other nations. But we also know other nations observe what the United States of America is doing with the sovereigns within this country that they have treaties with, because other nations have treaties with this country. And by observing how they're treating with the sovereigns of this country are truly important when there is this relationship, which we call an obverse relationship, minted of the same coin, but opposite sides, the United States and the Nez Perce on one side and the U.S. on the other side. And there's a mutual benefit to the treaty that it was signed. And those mutual benefits need to be realized by both sides. And what one side of the coin does should not burden the other side. And so when we introduce the dams and the decline of something that's explicitly listed in the treaty under Article 3 that says we will have the right to fish at all usual and accustomed areas, well, that's something that we'd been doing for thousands of years, not 118 years, but dated back 16,500 years, thousands of generations. And that's what was secured in the treaty. That's what nations around the world, if we're to hold other nations responsible for environmental injustices, then we need to look at ourselves here, because we have a classic example of an environmental injustice, a tribal injustice from our standpoint, that is affecting us, that's burdening us, that we didn't sign up for. We didn't sign up to not have fish. We signed up to have fish in perpetuity, not fish on life support. Raise your hand if you would like to live on life support. Anyone. If you'd like to live on life support, raise your hand. Well, I guarantee that's where the salmon are, and that's where the state they're in. And they're not going to raise their hand either. That's not the negotiation. That's not what is supposed to be happening here. Sure, we built this during the Industrial Revolution, the end part of that, and it's great. There, you know, I've had parents that my dad worked on a powerhouse. I had two uncles worked for the Army Corps of Engineers, worked on these dams, helped build them, helped maintain them, and they're marvels. They are, but they're built with flaws. And why can't we correct those flaws? Why can't we correct our transportation? Those are the solutions. Those are the rooms that we need to be in. Those are the rooms that I definitely want to be in, where we're solving the problems that we created years and years ago for the future.
Thank you. So the on the Klamath, the conflict around the dams really blew up in the early 2000s in the 2004 elections, and it became Eastern Oregon farmers versus downstream tribes and commercial fishermen about water access, and the Bush administration jumped in. I talked to a NOAA scientist who answered a phone and says, "This is Dick Cheney," and she said, "Yeah, Jack," and hung up, thinking I was being punked by her friend. And 2 minutes later, her boss called and said, "You just hung up on the Vice President of the United States." So a lot of conflict, but the result over time was collaboration. And the upstream farmers and the power company in the states began working together. So I guess this is for Bill. Do you have any sense the salmon are threatened? I mean, Rush Limbaugh back then was talking about sucker fish versus farmers because he couldn't say farmers versus salmon. Salmon are charismatic. Do you have any sense that there's, on the agricultural sector, there's the beginning of collaboration, or is there any consideration of what it might look like to transition from barges to rail, or any of these issues, or are people talking to each other about this?
Well, I think, yeah, good point, Dave. You know, it's happening because I am part of this panel. I have two counterparts from my, you know, from my area who live in Lewiston, who know the dynamics, good and bad of it, and. And the industry realizes that there's, as the vice chairman indicated, there's two sides to this coin. And the solution has to be simultaneous. And you find in Congressman Simpson's proposal that to work with the stakeholders, tribes, river businesses, transportation, and he really opened that conversation up, and I think that's partly the reason that that we're here talking about it, trying to find a solution. So it's very active, it's very dynamic, and I think you know, and as I propose some solutions, I think there's a lot of dynamics that have to, and a lot of discussions that have to happen. And this is a perfect forum for that to continue. So.
And Eric, are you seeing people talking to each other more than, or are they still talking past each other?
Perhaps a little bit, but there's still a lot of controversy. There's still a lot of people that are, you know, have baked in opinions and sort of not come out of the trenches yet on this issue. You know, some irrigators around the Tri-Cities seem willing to talk a little bit. But I get from like a lot of the ag folks and the folks on the power side, I have a sense that they feel if they collaborate that they are helping something to happen that they don't want to happen. So that there hasn't been a great deal of that. I mean, there's probably been more of it since the Simpson proposal, and it's almost like there needs to be more of a imminent feeling that something is going to happen, so we better negotiate before there'll be a lot of people coming to the table. And you know, one thing I didn't cover is there's been a long-running lawsuit throughout all of this, and the Nez Perce tribe are a big driver behind that. And there's negotiations, mediated negotiations going on right now. So that's something that could. Could change things, and that's supposed to wrap up later this summer.
Right. And Helen, you're, I mean, this is moving slightly to the side, but as the scientist here, You could talk, this isn't just Snake River salmon. This is globally salmon are in trouble. And wild salmon also have to deal with, you know, with hatchery fish and farm fish as well. What's sort of the global status? And I'm not into the, you know, I mean, I don't want to talk about hope versus fear. It's more like triage at this point. Save what you can while you can. So what's the global look on salmon?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that salmon are in trouble globally because of the footprint that humans have exerted everywhere. You know, you mentioned hatchery salmon. There are over 5 billion hatchery fish pumped into the ocean every year, and that causes a great deal of competition for the native stocks, and that's something that we can work to try and manage better, I think. You know, with the snake system, though, there's no doubt, as Bill stated, that ocean conditions are declining and becoming more extreme and volatile. But the key is that in the snake, you know, all of the modeling very clearly shows that the way the fish respond in the ocean is very dependent on what they experience here in the fresh water. So when we can change their experience in the fresh water to reduce stress and allow them to reach the ocean in better condition, they are much more able to weather what happens in the ocean. And I'm getting this information from, there's something called the Comparative Survival Study. It's one of the longest studies that's been done for several decades. It's a collaboration of the Columbia River Intertribal Commission, the Oregon, Idaho, and Fish and Wildlife Service, who have been tagging and monitoring these fish over decades. And so it's modeled, but based on observational data of tracking the fish through the powerhouses, through the system, tracking whether they're barged or how they pass, whether they go through spill, how many dams they, you know, have to circumvent in different ways, ocean conditions, water conditions, and how, and the numbers up here are basically the metric that follows all of that, and then how many of them return from a given cohort, which is what we look at for sustainability. And that study is just invaluable in giving us renewed information every year about the status of these fish, and very, very clearly shows that the, again, the fate of the fish once they reach the ocean is very dependent on their freshwater experience. So here I think that is a lever that we can manage. And like I said earlier, you know, the Snake River is really irreplaceable in terms of anchoring cold water habitat for these fish west-wide. So best bet to put your resources and efforts into salmon and steelhead are right here at the scale that we're talking about as well.
And I got to throw this in because I'm writing on it. How much is the Klamath Project impacting discussions up here as a Californian?
I mean, I think it's hope, it's progress, right? It's happening, and to me, that's amazing. I'm not in the world of all of the discussions more. I'm right. More on the science, but Shannon and
smaller dams, less irrigation, less power.
Sure, but biggest restoration related to dams in history. Coming soon.
Coming this summer. Before we get to questions, I just want to circle back. Cultural significance of salmon. You were talking about it, but in terms of, and I think, you know, people today all over the Pacific and people in Scotland missing the Atlantic wild salmon. But maybe just a few more words on how salmon is culture.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for that question, because it is who we are. And, you know, once again, we don't place ourselves above our food. We're equivalent to. And so we don't never pull ourselves and say, there's salmon, they're down there. There's our roots, there's our berries, you know, there's the bulbs that are out there and our medicines. We're all the same. And we understand that, you know, we are tied to the land in that way, and our blood is tied back to us. And that's truly what's important to us, is that, you know, they're equivalent and we're equivalent. And I just wanted to give, I'd given this previously about the significance of the water that's with it, and And of course, we manage from ridgetop to ridgetop and understand that the DNA can be, salmon DNA can be found in the trees at the top, and definitely can be found in the fields that we're growing, you know, wheat or barley in, or any of the bush, any of the areas, the pasture land or wherever. There's some type of salmon DNA that's missing from that could come missing with the depletion of the millions that once entered the system. And you know, that's a long-term thing, that you know, you're deprived of something for so long that you're either you can acclimate to it or you cannot acclimate to it. And we don't know the effects of that in the long term. You know, we know that we're dealing with industry changes, whether it's logging, whether it's you know, agriculture practices, those things that are depleting nutrients, and those things that are makeup of what I mentioned before when Lewis and Clark found the Garden of Eden, so to say. And so when that is when that changes, and as we look to try to change and restore and rebuild the Pacific Northwest into a sustainable Pacific Northwest, a stronger, better, smarter Pacific Northwest, then that part of the culture of what it means to tribes and all tribes, and that's one of the things that united all of us tribes when Congressman Simpson's proposal was coming out, of course, having conversations there. We reached out, Nespers reached out to all the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission tribes, the Umatilla, Yakima, and Warm Springs. Then we reached out to the 15 Columbia Basin tribes. So there's 15 Columbia Basin tribes within that area that are within the United States. There's the Kalispell, Kootenai, Spokane, Colville, Shoshone Bannock, Shoshone Paiute, Shoshone Burns Paiute, Yakima, Umatilla, Warm Springs, Grand Ronde, and the Nez Perce. They're all a part of this discussion. And one thing that tied us all together, this golden thread, was salmon and the impacts of the lack of salmon. And so culturally, it means so much to us. It means so much to our health. It means so much to our identity. And without it, we can see the impacts to some of the tribes that are lost currently right now that don't have salmon in their area. So culturally, it's who we are.
And actually, I got one more question before we open it up. The Fisher, what is it?
Anadromous,
which I think means your state legislature may not let them use a bathroom other than their natal birth sex. But you're all Idaho folk. We focus on particular issues. In terms of Idaho, how much is this an issue? I know housing is a huge issue. I know affordable housing and the influx of people. In terms of the top five political issues in the state, is salmon in that top five? I guess start with Eric, because
I'm not sure it's in the top five. I mean, in my world, it's the top issue politically. But, Governor Brad Little had a salmon task force. The majority of that group did not endorse breaching the dams. It affects every part of the state. It affects water throughout the state, from southern Idaho, all the way up to where I am. Representative Simpson's constituents send water downstream to help the salmon. So it's a big issue, but it doesn't come up in the political discussion all the time. But I it's always sort of there in the background. It's an important issue in my neck of the woods for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if they were like groupers, they're transsexual fish. go ahead.
Well, I think it isn't the top five, but it's a category of the environment, is how I would describe it. I think the environment is front and center on the average person's radar screen, whether they read the Lewiston Morning Tribune or not. So I think it's within the category of environment. That was a definite maybe to that answer.
I don't have any, I mean, you know, there's guides, anglers, whole communities that depend on these fish. It really depends on where you are and who you're talking to, but I think in certain regions of the state with certain groups, it's front and center all the time. Whether or not it makes it into our Capitol building here frequently is a different, kind of a different issue, but there are lots of people who are feeling this directly.
Right, and that's, you know, what goes on in the state capitals doesn't always reflect right. What people feel day to day. So we're going to open it up again. We got plenty of time for questions. SCGA members, please, and if for particular people, please focus, identify yourself and your outlet.
Thank you for that question. And you know, I think for the time being, you know, because of commercial needs and angler needs, sportsmen's needs, that hatchery fish are a part of this. You know, we hope that our hatcheries work themselves out of a job and the restoration work that's being done. And of course, you know, you're looking at that red section up there. There's a lot of ESA listed species in that red section. And a lot of them were, you know, recently on listed on that quasi-extinction threshold where there's 50 or fewer native spawners returning for four consecutive years to that tributary. And that's truly what's happening now. And you know, we hear about a lot of different things that are part of restoration and getting the fish back. And I think that the hatchery fish are a part of the process right now. Will they have to remain in existence until the natural native spawners return to healthy, harvestable, abundant numbers? Yes, I do believe that. But you know, in the context of the 5%, what we talked about, and I like to use this analogy for say the door frames here that we walked in into this room. Well, the fish are at the bottom where that washboard's at currently right now. That's where the fish are. ESA listed delisting is above that, maybe 8 inches above that, a foot above that. And that's just the ESA listed, the delisting. And then the healthy, harvestable, abundant numbers are about 3 feet up that door frame. But the historical number, now that's the top of that door frame. That's the historical numbers that have been coming through, and historically the amounts of fish, you know, range up to, well, I've heard 20 million, 16 million into the Columbia River system, and then into the Snake River system. That number is, of course, being it's the largest tributary to the Columbia River, so a good portion of that's coming from this beautiful area. That's wilderness that doesn't need restoration work. We can't do nothing out there. We've done restoration work in the areas that we can work in, but the problem is the bottleneck, the corridor that is happening. And so I think, you know, in the meantime, hatchery fish probably need to be around for those purposes of you know, consumption, because we definitely harvest those too as well. But that's not our end goal. Our end goal isn't just to keep hatchery fish around. Our end goal is to get native spawners fish to that healthy, harvestable, abundant number.
You know, and I would add, you know, as Shannon said, wilderness area here is anchoring a lot of the habitat integrity here. I mean, we have Idaho and houses, or the Snake River Basin has about 40% of the wilderness areas across the Pacific, across the West and the lower 48. So that's a big part of this. There are systems that are under habitat restoration currently. So we do have some more degraded systems that are having active, you know, tons and tons of collaborative effort with ranchers and agencies and tribes. Tribes are doing a lot of this restoration work. Everyone is invested in restoring these habitats where they need it, restoring connectivity, removing culverts. But the problem is we will never see the return on that investment because, as Vice Chairman Wheeler said, the bottleneck is in the dams. And so we need the dams to come out so that we can all see the return on the investments that have been put in this area already. And, you know, to your other point about a river is a larger thing, not just the fish, but it is a broken ecosystem here. I mean, we simply don't have the food web. Salmon are food for an entire ecosystem, right? As Vice Chairman Wheeler mentioned, they feed the trees. They feed, you know, hundreds of species throughout this region. And we need the fish back to rebuild a healthy ecosystem, to rebuild all of this. I mean, I think it's really hard. You know, you see the modeling that comes out of the predictions from, like, the comparative survival study, for instance. It's predicting a return on these fish if we can improve passage. But that's all based on current observations, and so it doesn't even account for this compounding effect of these other aspects of a more complex ecosystem as well.
And in terms of climate change, we're seeing warming waters in the ocean. We've had the collapse of our kelp forest, especially in Northern California, over the last years. A lot of rivers are warming up. In terms of preserving biodiversity, what also makes the Snake River salmon kind of unique?
Yeah, I mean, cold water, for one, right? You know, this is some of the coldest habitat out there. And I actually think what I want to dig into is I think there's probably a fair amount of habitat there that is too cold for salmon currently. It's funny, we talk about temperature always as the limiting factor, and it very well can be. But fish actually respond to temperatures in positive ways within a realm. They grow much bigger in reasonably suitable warmer temperatures. And so I do think there's actually probably opportunity within the snake for that to express itself as well with climate change. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. I mean, the flow limitations are the key, right? You have to have water. But there's a lot of habitat in the snake where the fish can expand, and currently they don't use it because the other thing is we're also, when abundances are low, they are not distributing across a lot of the habitat, and they don't have the ability to express all these diverse life histories. I mean, Chinook salmon have, I think, 18 different life histories of fish that rear different amounts of time and fresh and go out to the ocean at different times and return at different times. That's their buffering strategy. But they don't express those full complexes when numbers are this low. Right. Or, you know, so.
But they're the highest salmon in the world, right? I mean, when they go up to 6,000 feet. Questions?
Yeah, questions.
Oh, okay. You and you. Go ahead.
Well, the comparative survival study actually does. So let me just orient you around what these numbers represent here. I think one of the, you know, I talked about the fact that some of the statistics you hear don't look at the cumulative impacts of the dam. So one of the important statistics or biological metrics that we can use that actually gets at most of it is this smolt to adult return. So it's basically for every cohort of smolts that go out, how many adults do you get coming back? Basically, is the population replacing itself? It's sustainability. And that's what the comparative survival study studies, from the headwaters of the Snake Pit Tag arrays up in the headwaters here, through all eight dams, through ocean passage, back and up eight dams, and actually then extrapolates back through the tag stations that are in the tributaries to spawning grounds. And so these metrics basically represent that SAR value, and it has to be above one for these populations to be replacing themselves. You can see that the Snake River is not sustainable. That is, like, ecologically not sustainable. These populations are declining. Whereas the lower John Day River that passes three dams and the Yakima that passes four dams, you know, have 3 to 4 times. Sometimes those SARs are up to 9 in some of those lower systems, support fisheries. It's a very different picture. But, yes, that comparative survival study that's been going on since 1996, I think, It has an independent science advisory board that reviews it every year. People give comments, the Nez Perce give comments, scientists give comments. They respond to that every year. They, you know, it's a really impressive effort. So I would point you to that
okay,
for sure.
And yes.
I think you have a question.
Chris Clayton, I'm an agricultural journalist from Omaha, Nebraska. I spent a little bit of time earlier this week visiting the grain elevators up on the state.
Right.
Eric, you talked about the litigation a little bit, and they've got that federal mediation aspect of that go on. What's the situation with the laws for litigation, and can the federal judge actually force the removal of the buildings?
Well, that's a matter of debate, I think. The general perception is that it would require an act.
Most people think it would require an act of Congress. You know, just to authorize it to get the money, and if it's going to follow something like the Simpson proposal, which you know, is $33.5 billion is cost. That's much more than it would cost to remove the dams. Most of that money is to make people whole, to mitigate for it. So in that sense, it would take an act of Congress. There is some folks that think perhaps there's a way for it to happen. You know, without Congress, I don't know enough about that avenue to talk about it. They're looking for a long-term solution to the salmon and dams problem, essentially, and that's all happening behind closed doors. So we don't know what's going on. Breaching, we do know that breaching is something that's being talked about. It's on the table. To the degree that it's on the table, we don't know.
Political question earlier. There were public comments periods 2 weeks ago as part of that litigation to have the public give comments, and the vast majority of comments were for dam removal. It was pretty interesting to see how that was weighing out in those comments. So just to throw that
out. Do you have any sense of where those comments were coming? Were they organized NGO groups? Were they the public? Or
there were actually a lot of people from Idaho. Eric? A lot of NGOs.
I don't think it was representative. I think
probably not, but
yeah.
But for, you know, the people who took the time to get on, sign up, and be part of it,
no, good. We're inciting more questions. I think you were next. And then,
I mean, I think it's going to be yet another example of where we can see the resilience of these fish, right? The neat thing about the Klamath situation is they are letting it play out for a period of time before introducing hatchery fish, for instance, or using that as the way to get the fish back in. There's a period of letting the fish come back in naturally. And it's been a really, you know, I think I'm not as involved in that process, but the tribes have been real leaders. The communities are finally, you know, have come together now and have structured this in a way that I think can offer a really positive example for us all. And it's a matter now of watching the fish do their work, like we're seeing in other systems.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, we're definitely, you'll learn a lot from it, and you know, a free-flowing river, well, what it'll produce and what it hasn't produced. And I think as we continue to watch it, of course, the difference, of course, are FERC dams, where these are federal dams, and there's a little bit different dynamic there that is a part of that process. And for us, you know, just getting the timing of this, because a lot of times, you know, we have moving goalposts with what needs to be replaced. And so if it's energies, the moving goalposts each time, well, Climate Commitment Act, well, we need X amount of megawatts of power generation by 2050. Well, now we're going to go to 2050 now, and you guys have to be able to answer to 2050, not to 2023 and or even prior to that, where we could have. And so really solidifying some goals, I think, is what the difference is between those two, that being able to watch those things. And I mean, like low-hanging fruit, like irrigation and transportation are easy fixes. I mean, you know, but the fish, like Congressman Simpson says, the fish need a river to to survive, and I think that's what the Klamath will prove, that fish given a chance are resilient and will come back, just like in the Elwha. And so we look forward to seeing that. You know, I have a lot of friends, I have a lot of family that's Yurok tribal members that they're excited. They're excited for it, and we, you know, we know there's a lot of work that's going to have to be done, you know, on the ground because of the restoration work of the you know, for me, I use it as a like blockage. My dad had heart disease. He had blockage clear through his veins, and dams produce blockage, sediment that should be flowing and nutrients that should be getting to the ocean that aren't. It's backed up. I mean, you hear different things about dredging and all that, and what's coming out of that. Well, a lot of that's coming off of agriculture fields and practice, past practices. But you know, like I said, what we learn from the past, you know, we should learn something from the past. If we can't learn something from the past, then well, step aside and let someone that can actually analyze that and has learned from the past and do it differently.
Could you speak into the mic?
I think the Klamath might also show us how rivers respond. And I think you guys touched on that a little bit. But I wrote about the Klamath, and the interesting part to me about that was how quickly it pushed 100 years of sediment out to sea and how quickly the river actually recovered. And that's a big concern in the Snake. There's a hell of a lot of sediment built up behind those dams. And these Klamath dams, I think, are a little bit more like the Snake River dams as compared to a really short coastal river like the Elwha. So I'm going to be really interested in watching that, too.
Yeah, and I think it may not parallel totally the Snake and dam removal, but I think it should be indicative, because I think there's about 200 miles of habitat that was opened up. And I think it's there's a lot of interest in the results of that one change.
Just one more thing I'd like to add to that too is because removal and breaching are two different things, right? So we'll be breaching the dams, which there's an earthen portion of the dam that isn't the actual dam itself. It's not the concrete structure, but the earthen portion that'll be removed. I mean, it could be removed within a year. I mean, we've already done all this. The studies have already been done. It's just getting that out of the way. So a lot of misconceptions out there about that. So that's the one clarifying misconception that I'd like to put out there. It's not a removal of dams. It's a breaching of dams.
You mean so you don't get to watch it get dynamited? Man, you're disappointing a lot of reporters here.
Yeah, the question is what Production Ag as one of the stakeholders in this equation, what would it take to keep us whole? I think first of all, it's going to take continued dialogue as we get closer to finding a solution and weighing the options. I think without dialogue, I'm not certain of any outcome being. Great for everyone, or even part of the participants. So, as I touched on, wheat is not the only crop grown in the inland Northwest. About 240 million bushels are grown of white wheat in the Northwest, which is 90-some% exported. Yeah, so it goes down the river. A little bit of it goes rail, but most of it down the river. And so what my operation has done is looking to markets of other products that are not reliant on the river. I'm fortunate to have farm storage and relationship with tenants who I can work with and market that product domestically, because if you take the lack of competition for moving wheat down the river, if you have to go to rail or other or truck or a tube or whatever we come up with, it makes it less economically viable and feasible, and that's capitalized back in the value of farm ground and, you know, via profitability. So it has impacts on local and state governments. And so we're looking at the 40% of what we grow will probably expand to non-exportable commodities that we work through, we have partners with and work through. Not everybody can do that because it takes some innovation and some work, and it takes a good banker, because you just don't haul it to the terminal and get a check for it. It takes sometimes a year to get that product marketed. So it's not an easy solution. I'm quite optimistic that some solutions can be found for wheat, as well as for shifting that percentage to a few other crops and being less reliant.
And I guess the other part of your question is, did you see anything good in the Simpson proposal?
I appreciate the Simpson's proposal a lot. I was one of the people he sat out and talked with as before it came out, and it's provided a place for dialogue. I think this form and function of this group and the dialogue around it and the interest around it was driven by Congressman Simpson, much to the chagrin of some people. But quite frankly, I felt it was very positive. And I think it gave an opportunity for people to come together and realize that there's a number of stakeholders and positions in this that aren't quite obvious to everybody.
Great. And, Tim, you'll be the last question. So. Why don't you say who you are?
Yeah, great question. Simpson proposal, roughly $35 billion was earmarked to be set aside, for stakeholders and to work through the details. Those were never really defined. The concept was put forward. Some numbers were attached to it. And I think, as I said earlier, I think there's a number of discussions that need to occur. What is the economics? What are the alternatives? Not only for tribe fishing and not only for river usage, but for the indirect stakeholders and the consequences of this. I think there's a solution. I really feel quite positive, and Simpson set the mark, I think, by volume this and actually attaching some numbers to it. They're not solid, and I wasn't trying to argue what the value was of a certain component of or a certain stakeholder, but I think that is one of the one of the things we need to work on, and I'm quite ready to have that conversation,
Great. And yesterday we were talking with one of the fish biologists from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who is – I asked the time frame, and he said that – Forest Service. Thank you. Russ?
Russ Thoreau.
Russ Thoreau. Asking the time frame, because it took us 20 years to get to yes on the Klamath, and he said 20 years is sort of the outside margin. So, we're in a extinction crisis, we're in a climate crisis, we're in an emergency situation. And, sometimes apocalypse is a great opportunity to tell good stories. So I think, and I hope that a lot of you will follow up with questions and stories, and in the interim, and feel free to come up and talk directly with folks. Again, I'd like to thank Shannon and Helen and Bill and Eric for being available to us today, and really appreciate it.